shadows on the tree trunks around him. A sudden snap from the fire startled him, and he felt the uneasiness returning. Time for sleep, he told himself stoutly. He closed his eyes, but only for a moment. The darkness around him felt too big. Watching the fire for a while longer would lull him, he decided. It worked. Between the warmth and the steady flickering of the flames, his eyelids grew heavy. Trier suddenly jerked wide awake. He had heard a noise that was not the noise of the fire. It was so slight that it almost wasn't a noise, a whisper of movement, a disturbance in the still night air. He raised himself up on one elbow, listening, searching in the dim light of the newly risen half-moon. Perhaps it was nothing. Then he heard it again. This time there was no doubt. Something was moving through the forest not far from him, something light-footed, an animal slipping weightlessly over the leaves. Slowly, slowly he picked up the jigge. He meant to squeeze it into the hollow between the two boulders, but could not do so silently. The branches of the jigge scraped against the granite. Trier froze, holding his breath. This would never do. He had to work quickly, or the creature, whatever it was, would be upon him before he knew it. He shoved the jigge into the opening, put his back to it, and wiggled in himself. There was not enough room. He crouched, hunched over with his chin on his knees, and waited, his heart nearly bursting through his chest. Would the beast stay away from the fire? It was dying now, not much more than a bed of coals. Trier cursed himself for not having put more wood nearby. The sound was coming closer. He could hear the rustle of leaves, clearly off to his left. On the ground before him was a stick. It was only a twig, but Trier reached for it anyway. He stripped the leaves from it and gripped it tightly. Perhaps, he thought wildly, he could blind the beast as it clawed at him, trying to drag him from between the rocks. How long would he have to wait? The moments crawled by. Then, without further warning, the creature came into view. It was a fox. Trier felt his pulse pounding in his throat. His thoughts seemed to be running a desperate race with each other. Against a fox he was defenseless. The fox would stare at him, looking deep into his eyes, bewitching him until he rose to follow it to its lair. He would never see Crane Man or Ajima again. The vases would remain hidden between the rocks for eternity. There would be nothing left of him but a pile of gnawed bones. The fox turned its head. For an instant the firelight gleamed in its eyes. "Don't look!" Trier shouted to himself. "Don't look at its eyes! It's your only chance!" And he squeezed his eyes shut to block out the fox's evil stare. How long he waited, he did not know. He opened his eyes after what seemed a lifetime. Had he been bewitched, despite his efforts? Was he in the fox's lair, conscious for one last moment before a painful, bloody death? Trier blinked to clear his vision. The fox was gone. He was still wedged into the opening between the rocks, his muscles aching with cramp. He dared not move. It was probably just another of the fox's tricks. If he were to emerge from shelter, the fox would be there, waiting for him. No. He would have to remain there, alert for any trap the devilish creature might spring. The sound of crying birds awoke him. For a moment, Trier did not know where he was. He shifted slightly, and a corner of the jigge's frame jabbed him rudely in the back. Sunlight streamed gloriously through the trees. It was morning. Could it be? He had fallen asleep. He had slept for who knew how long, with a fox nearby, and he had survived. Trier laughed out loud, and the sound of his laughter reminded him of his friend. "We are afraid of the things we do not know, just because we do not know them," Trier thought, pleased with himself. He must remember the idea. Crane Man would be interested in discussing it. And he wiggled out of the crevice, grimacing ruefully at the tight knots in what seemed like every one of his muscles. A day's walk beyond the next village lay the city of Puyo. Although Trier was determined to go straight to Songdo without delay, Crane Man had counseled him to make one stop at a place called the Rock of the Falling Flowers in Puyo. "It is an old, old story," Crane Man had said, and Trier had settled down on his sleeping mat, wriggling around for the most comfortable position. "You know that our little land has suffered many invasions," Crane Man began. "The powers that surround us, China, Japan, the Mongols, have never left us in peace for long. This is the story of one such invasion. It was the Tang Chinese this time, all of 500 years ago. Puyo was then the capital of the Bakje Kingdom, one of the three kingdoms that shared the land. The Tang, allied with the Shira Kingdom, swept down from the north and pushed their way into Puyo. Most of the king's army having been called away to fight the war, there were only a handful of personal guards to defend him. The king received warning, but it was too late. As he and all his courtiers fled the palace, the Tang were snapping at their heels. The king and his party were forced to retreat to the very highest point of Puyo, a cliff overlooking the Kum River. There was no escape. Bravely, the king's guards placed themselves a little way down the path between the enemy and their sovereign. They were overrun in moments. All of the king's concubines and ladies-in-waiting crowded around him, determined to protect him to the last. The women knew well that the Tang would not kill them. No, they would be taken prisoner, probably to be tortured. Their terror can hardly be imagined. Crane Man paused and sipped at his tea. Tree Ear was no longer lying down. He had risen to his knees in the excitement of the story. "Is that all?" he demanded. "Patience, monkey. The best is yet to come." Crane Man stared into the fire for a moment. The Tang army charged up the hill. All at once, as if all their minds had become one, the women began jumping off the cliff. Every one of them preferred death to becoming a prisoner. "Can you see it, my friend? The women jumping one after another from the cliff, their beautiful silk dresses billowing in the air, pink, red, green, blue, indeed, like flowers falling." Tyr gasped, his eyes round. What courage it must have taken. The Tang were victorious that day, but the women's efforts were not in vain, for they have since been an inspiration to all who have need of courage. Their memory will live for 1,000 years, I am sure of it. Crane Man reached out with his crutch and poked the dying embers of the fire. Tria saw sparks flare up and fall again like tiny flowers. "Go climb the rock of the falling flowers when you reach Puyo, my friend," Crane Man had said. "But remember that leaping into death is not the only way to show true courage." Now Puyo lay just ahead. Tria strode eagerly down the road. He would visit the rock, and when he returned home, he would tell Crane Man everything he had seen. The villages along Tree Ear's route thus far were much like Chulpo. They were not seaside villages, and they were inhabited by farmers rather than potters, but they had the same feel as Chulpo. Small thatched houses gathered in clusters along a single main road, the grand home of a government official set apart from the rest, a temple somewhere nearby, people working hard for a meagre living. Everyone had been kind and respectful, going about their business as he went about his. But Puyo! Tria entered the city gates and stopped in mid-step. How crowded it was! People, oxen and carts jostled one another in the narrow streets. The houses were so close together that Tria wondered how their residents could breathe. Behind him he heard shouts of impatience as people tried to push past him. He moved on, swept along by the river of traffic. On both sides of the street, shop stalls were open. Their owners shouted, plying their wares. The customers shouted, bargaining for the best prices. Never had Tria seen so many goods displayed or heard so much noise. How could the people of Puyo possibly hear themselves think? There were stalls that sold food and drink, already prepared, and stalls that sold vegetables and fish for cooking at home. One stall sold nothing but sweets. There were bolts of fine silk, trays of gemstones, wooden toys. All manner of household goods could be had, baskets and straw sleeping mats and wooden chests. And pottery. Tria stopped abruptly in front of one stall. It was stacked with small mountains of pottery, not celadon work, but the very dark brown stoneware known as ongi, for storing food. The ongi seller's stall displayed every size of vessel, from tiny sauce dishes to kimchi jars big enough for a man to stand hidden within. The wares were stacked in tall towers that seemed to tilt precariously, but Tria smiled, knowing they were steadier than they looked. He had learned well how to stack similar-sized vessels into a tower that could touch the sky, if need be, and never topple. Tria was just about to move on when he spotted a shelf at the back of the stall. His mouth dropped open in amazement. Just three objects stood on this shelf, three identical celadon wine bowls, inlaid with chrysanthemums. The owner noticed Tria's interest.
"Boy, tell your master the latest style those bowls are. The design is a favourite of the king himself. I dare not tell you what I paid for them. Only a customer of impeccable taste can afford such an item. Is your master such a one?"
Tria did not mean to be rude, but he could not speak. He merely bowed his head to the man and stepped away from the stall, feeling a little dizzy. Geng's designs, already seen and admired and replicated for sale on the streets of Puyo. Trier began to walk faster, shouldering his way through the crowds. The sooner the better for Min's work to reach Songdo. Chapter 11. The path to the Rock of the Falling Flowers was steep, and Trier leaned forward, sometimes on all fours, as he climbed. Just before he reached the top, he stopped by the side of the path and took the jigge off his back. He drank from the gourd and poured a little water on his hands to splash on his sweaty face. Thus refreshed, he felt ready to give his full attention to the sight of the rock. He walked the last incline, holding the jigge awkwardly in front of him, and set it down once he reached the broad plateau at the top. It was as if he stood alone on top of the world. He gazed around, this way and that, hardly knowing where to look first. Before him, to the north, the cliff fell away sharply to the Kum River, a broad stroke of silver ribboning its way through the hills and plains. Behind him was the path he had climbed, with the city of Puyo below. How small it looked now! Trier shaded his eyes from the sun as it began to set, wondering if that smudge on the horizon might be the sea. Surely this cliff was high enough to see all the way there. Crane Man's words came to life. The king standing where Trier stood now, surrounded by the palace women, the enemy scrambling up the path he had just followed, the cries of the women, their terror, and then their sudden act of bravery, their coloured dresses like the petals of thousands of flowers.
"You know the story, eh?"
The voice at his side startled Trier. He felt his heart leap and run. He had not heard the man come up the path, but there he stood, poorly dressed and oddly pale, as if he had been ill for a long time, or never went outdoors when the sun shone. Trier cleared his throat.
"Greetings, sir. Have you eaten well today?"
"Not today. Not for a few days now," came the impolite answer. The man smiled, but Trier did not like his smile. There was something unpleasant behind it. Although he would have preferred to stay at the rock a while longer, he decided to descend rather than remain in unwanted company. Trier turned and picked up his jigge, preparing to hoist it to his back.
"Let me help you with that," the man said, moving forward.
"A fine load of rice indeed."
Trier stepped back, trying to quell his alarm. His cargo was far more precious than rice.
"Your offer is kind, good sir, but I have no need of help."
The man's smile turned into a leer.
"Now there's a rude boy. My help is no good to you."
And he reached out with one arm to grab the jigge. Trier jerked it away from him. He stumbled, coming dangerously near the edge of the cliff. The man snarled, menacing and ugly, and advanced a few steps. He seized the sides of the straw container with both hands and pulled. In the last moments, everything had come together in Trier's mind. The man's pallor, his rudeness, his coming upon Trier in such a deserted place. He was one of the dreaded Todoknon, the bandits who hid throughout the countryside and on the outskirts of cities, emerging only to rob weary travellers. Trier held on to the wooden frame of the jigge with all his might. The robber pulled and jerked. Crane Man's solid straw work held. At one point the man released one hand, cursing. The straw had cut into his palm. Trier's hands were toughened by calluses from axe and spade, his arms strengthened by endless work. He gave not a single step of ground to the robber.
"Be careful!" A scream of warning sounded in Trier's head. "You are pulling so hard. If he lets go suddenly, you will fall. Move! Move now, so your back is not to the cliff edge!"
Trier shifted his feet and began edging sideways. Still the robber pulled, now shouting curses and threats with every breath. Soon Trier's back was to the path. His hands and arms felt like iron. They would never break. He would never let go. The robber was weakening. He could feel it. Trier stared into the robber's face. Hatred would give him more strength, and it did, too. Silently he swore to himself that this dog of a man would never win the jigge with its priceless contents. The man stared back at him, his face contorted in an evil grimace. But suddenly he laughed and released the container. Trier collapsed backwards into the arms of another man who had stolen up the path behind him. A second robber. Against two, Trier could do nothing. The second man pinned his arms back while the first strode forward and wrenched the jigge away. Trier kicked and struggled. His head crashed into the chin of his captor, who swore in pain. The other robber reached out and slapped Trier's face viciously.
"Stop your struggle, worthless one," he said. "We mean only to rob you, but it would not be past us to harm you if you prove too much trouble."
While his companion kept tree opinioned, the first robber quickly opened the straw container. He threw aside the packing of straw and silk, growing angrier with each handful.
"Not rice! What is it you are carrying, idiot boy?"
At last, he drew out the first of the vases, and his face grew purple with fury.
"Useless!"
he screamed, gripping the mouth of the vase with one hand and waving it about. Trier caught his breath with fear.
"We might sell it," said the second robber, more calmly.
"Have you no eyes in your head?" his companion shouted back. "Look at it! Can't you see this could only be a gift for the palace? Nobody would dare buy it from us."
"Keep looking. Perhaps there is something more."
The robber set the first vase down on the ground and returned to his search of the container. With more muttered curses, he pulled out the second vessel and threw a final handful of straw on the ground.
"Nothing!"
he screamed.
"All the way up this hill, and nothing!"
His companion had shifted his grip and now had one arm across Tree-Ear's throat, throttling him so he could barely breathe. With his other hand, he pawed roughly at Tree-Ear's waist pouch.
"Hey, here is something to cheer you up."
He held the pouch in his free hand and emptied the contents onto the ground. The flintstones and the little clay turtle fell out, followed by the string of coins.
"Something, anyway," grumbled the first robber, scooping up the coins. He kicked the jiggy out of his way and headed down the path.
"Come, we've wasted enough time here."
Trier breathed a silent prayer of thanks.
"Take the money, take anything, just leave the vases alone."
The second robber laughed.
"Wait," he said. "Come, hold this donkey for a moment."
The first robber retraced his steps.
"What is it?"
he asked impatiently, grabbing Trier by the arms from behind.
"A little fun, as long as we're up here."
The robber picked up one of the vases. He stepped to the edge of the cliff and flung it into the air. Peering over the edge, he put his hand to his ear in a pose of listening. After an agony of silence, the crash of pottery was heard on the rocks far below. The second robber laughed again.
"One more,"
he said in a jovial voice.
"No!"
Trier screamed, an inhuman screech of utter desperation. The robber holding him lifted him off his feet and slammed him to the ground so hard that his breath left him. And Trier could only watch as the second vase sailed through the air. With a yelp, like a wounded dog, he put his hands over his ears so he would not hear the crash. Trier rolled onto his side and vomited. He retched again and again until his stomach felt as empty as his spirit. Shakily, he rose to his feet and bent over double, his hands on his knees. Failure. The most dishonorable failure. He had been unable to keep the vases safe. Puyo was not even halfway to Songdo. If he had reached his destination and the work had been rejected by the court, at least he would have done his part. He raised his head slowly and stared at the edge of the cliff. He thought of returning to Min with this news, and his whole body shuddered. Nothing could be worse. He straightened up and took a few steps toward the edge. What would it be like to leap off and sail through the air as those women had, like flying, like a bird, so free? And time would feel different. Those few moments would feel like hours, surely. But just then he heard Crane Man's voice so clearly that he turned in surprise. Leaping into death is not the only way to show true courage. No one was there, of course. Trier stepped back from the edge, ashamed. He knew it was true. It would take far more courage to face Min. He thought of his promise to Ajima, and besides, Crane Man was waiting for him. It was his duty to return. He picked up his waist pouch and put the flintstones and the turtle back inside. Then he untied the few items from the jigge. There was one pair of sandals. He had donned the other spare pair the day before. The food bag still held a few rice cakes, but Trier felt that he would never be able to eat again. He tucked the pouch back under his tunic and slung the sandals, the food bag, and the drinking gourd over one shoulder. Then he stood for a few moments, staring at nothing. Gradually, the empty straw container came into focus before him. With a sudden cry of fury, Trier picked up the jiggy and threw it, container and all, over the edge of the cliff. He watched its descent. It did not fall cleanly to the water, but bounced several times off the rocks on its way down. Trier turned and began to run. He ran blindly down the mountain path, heedless of the rocks and shrubs. Several times he fell, but was on his feet again in the next breath, stumbling, tripping, skidding in a headlong descent. When at last he reached the point where the path leveled out, he fell hard onto his face, the dirt mixing with his tears. His teeth cut into his top lip, and he spat blood. The pain was welcome. He deserved far worse.
Trier sat up and wiped his face with the edge of his tunic, hearing nothing but the sound of his own panting and the rushing river nearby. Suddenly, a last flicker of hope flared within him. The second vase. He had not heard the crash. Perhaps it had fallen into the water. Perhaps it was still unbroken. Trier made his way around the base of the cliff to the river. Boulders blocked the way to a narrow strip of sand, with more rocks beyond. He looked up the sheer face of the cliff as it rose far above him and tried to guess where the vases might have fallen. Then he began scrambling over the boulders. Thorny shrubs grew among the rocks. Sometimes they massed into a wall so thick that he had to scramble down to the water's edge and wade to make further progress. If the vases had fallen among those shrubs, he would never be able to find them. That small mass on the sand up ahead, not as dark as the rocks, could that be a vase? Trier made his awkward way over the stony ground, barking his shin once, but hardly feeling the pain in his eagerness. No, a pile of pebbles. For a long time, he made his way back and forth between the cliff and the river, up and down over the rocks and sand. He had nearly given up hope when he came upon a little mound of shards. They would never have been noticed by a casual passer-by, so thoroughly smashed was the vessel that the fragments were no bigger than pebbles. Trier crouched and touched them gingerly. The first vase, he hoped, with all his might. He stood and looked around. The thief had thrown both vases from the same spot on the cliff. The other one should be somewhere nearby. At the river's edge, Trier saw something on the sand. He approached it slowly, telling himself it was probably another pile of pebbles or a piece of driftwood. It was the second vase. The force of its fall had driven it into the sand in 100 pieces. Trier dropped to his knees. Fool, he thought bitterly, fool, to hope that it could have survived such a fall. The second vase, its fall cushioned however slightly by the sand, had broken into bigger pieces. The largest shard was the size of his palm. Trier picked up this piece and swished it through the water to rinse off the sand. Across one side of the shard ran a shallow groove, evidence of the vase's melon shape. Part of an inlaid peony blossom with its stem and leaves twined along the groove, and the glaze still shone clear and pure, untouched by the violence that had just been done it. A sharp edge of the shard bit into Trier's palm. The pain was an echo, he remembered now. It was when he had thrown the shard from the first batch of ruined vases into the river in Chulpo. How long ago it seemed. Suddenly, Trier raised his head. He stood up and squared his shoulders, still clutching the piece of pottery. He laid the shard carefully on a flat stone. He took the clay turtle from his waist pouch and squeezed it back into a ball. Next, he rolled the clay between his palms until it formed a long snake. Picking up the shard again, he pinched the snake all the way around the sharp edge to protect it. Trier removed the flintstones from his waist pouch. They might scratch the shard. He tied them into one corner of his tunic, then put the clay-bound shard into the pouch. Holding the pouch clear of the boulders with one hand, he climbed back to the path. His every movement was quick with purpose. To hesitate was to doubt. He had made up his mind. He would journey on to Songdo and show the emissary the single shard. Chapter 12. The next several days passed in a steady blur. Trier walked and walked. The sun shone, he walked. Rain poured, he walked. From sunrise until dark, he walked without stopping, drinking from the gourd along the way. If dark found him near a village, he slept outside a house and accepted whatever was offered in the way of food. If there was no village, he slept in a ditch by the side of the road or under a tree in the forest. He ate, perhaps, once every 2 days, feeling no need of food but knowing that without it he could not complete the journey. Only once did he pause. A low range of mountains made a bowl of a valley cut through by a beautiful river. After crossing the valley, Trier stopped on a peak at the far side and looked back. He knew that the scene must be even lovelier than it now looked to him, viewed as it was through a fog of exhaustion that blurred his senses and his mind. Perhaps, on the way back, he would appreciate it more. 3 days' walk north of this valley brought him to Songdo. Songdo was like Puyo, only more so. More people, more buildings, more traffic. The palace was in the center of the city, towering over all other structures. Trier did not stop walking. Every step brought him closer to the palace. Once he shuffled sideways to avoid a woman with a toddler tied to her back.
The toddler was crying over some unknown disappointment, and the sound of his cries drew Tree-ear's attention. He watched as the mother comforted the child by rhythmically bouncing up and down and crooning to him. For just a moment, Tree-ear was distracted. He had been such a child once, right here in Songdo. He had lived here with his parents, a father and a mother. Perhaps his mother had comforted him in the same way when he had cried. Perhaps somewhere in one of the temples there was a monk who knew about his parents, who remembered sending him to Chulpo. Tree-ear sighed and looked back out on the street. The noise of the traffic seemed to press in on his ears, on his very body. Everywhere there were people hurrying about. There must be dozens of temples in the mountains surrounding Songdo. Even if Tree-ear could find that monk, it was likely that he would no longer remember. He might even be dead by now. It was useless to wonder. Tree-ear turned his mind back to his task. Late in the afternoon, Tree-ear made his steady way through the crowds and found the main gate of the palace. Two soldiers stood guard there. He spoke firmly. "I have an appointment with the Royal Emissary for Pottery Ware," he said, for that was Emissary Kim's full title. He made a dignified bow. The guards looked at Tree-ear, then at each other. Tree-ear could read their thoughts. "This scrawny scarecrow of a child claims a royal appointment." But he felt no trembling now. His calm did not even surprise him. He was expected. He had the right to be there. His manner must have said as much, for one of the guards vanished beyond the gate. He was gone long enough for the other guard to shift impatiently, but Tree-ear did not budge. He stood proudly, his eyes never leaving the gate. At last the guard returned, followed by another man. It was not Emissary Kim, but he was garbed in a similar robe, wearing a different hat, some kind of official of lower rank than Kim. He, too, looked skeptically at Tree-ear. "Yes?" he inquired, his politeness edged with impatience. Tree-ear bowed again. "I have an appointment with Emissary Kim. I am here on behalf of Potter Min from Chulpo." The official raised his eyebrows slightly. "Yes, all right. Where is the work? I will take it to Emissary Kim, and you may return for his answer in a few days." Tree-ear paused before he spoke. "I do not wish to displease the honourable gentleman, but I will not show what I have brought to anyone but the emissary." He drew in a silent breath to quell the small nudge of anxiety that was rising within him. So far, he had not been forced to lie. The official looked annoyed. "Emissary Kim is a very busy man. I do not wish to disturb him when he could view the work at his convenience." "Then I will wait for his convenience," said Tree-ear. He looked directly at the man. "Emissary Kim has specifically requested that Potter Min's work be brought to him. I do not wish him to be disappointed." His message was clear to the official. "I understand," the man said crossly, "but surely you do not expect to see him without showing him the work. Where is it?"
"I will discuss its whereabouts with no one but the emissary."
The official muttered under his breath and finally seemed to make up his mind. He nodded to the guards. The gate swung open, and Tree-ear stepped inside the royal courtyard. Inside the gate lay another small city. Buildings lined the walls, and across a wide stretch of open courtyard, Tree-ear could see the grandest of them all, the palace proper. Tree-ear nearly tripped as he walked, with his neck craned and his eyes wide. He had never before seen a building more than one story high. And wonder of wonders, the palace had celadon roof tiles. Tree-ear stopped walking. He had heard of these roof tiles. Years ago, before his time, potters in Chulpo had been engaged in the enormous task of making those very tiles. Wasters, the rejects, could still be found around the kiln site. How Tree-ear wished he could somehow climb the walls and examine the tiles more closely. Even from where he stood, he could make out their intricate relief work. All sorts of people went about their business, tradesmen and soldiers and officials and many monks. Reluctantly, Tree-ear turned his attention away from the tiles and caught up with his escort. The official led the way deeper into the palace grounds. He stopped at last before a building against the outer wall and gestured for Tree-ear to wait outside. After a few moments, the official returned and beckoned Tree-ear. Tree-ear walked through an entryway into a small room, small but lovely. Shelves along one wall held celadon vessels. Tree-ear could see at a glance that each piece was of the highest quality. The official who had led him in moved to stand at one side of the door in the stance of an assistant. Emissary Kim sat at a low wooden table. He was writing rapidly on a scroll, the brush racing across the paper, leaving behind a trail of perfectly formed characters. Tree-ear could not read, but he could see the skill of Kim's calligraphy. Kim wiped the brush carefully on the inkstone. He picked up the scroll and carried it to a shelf where it would dry. Then he returned to the table and sat again. He folded his arms and looked at Tre'ir. Tre'ir bowed low. As he bent down, his courage suddenly fled, leaving his knees as weak as reeds. "I must be hungry," he thought, as he straightened his body, incredulous that he could think of such a thing at such a moment.
"You are here from Chulpo, from Potter Min," the emissary stated.
"Yes, honourable sir."
The emissary waited. "Well," he said, "where is the work?" Tre'ir swallowed hard.
"Sir, on my way here, I was set upon by robbers. They destroyed my master's work."
The assistant stepped forward in anger.
"How dare you, brazen fool! How dare you demand an audience of the emissary with nothing to show him?"
He reached to grab Tre'ir's arm and yank him out the door. The weakness in Tre'ir's knees surged through his whole body now. The assistant was right. He had been a fool. First a failure, now a fool. But the emissary had risen to his feet and gestured at his aide, who stepped back, chastened.
"I am greatly disappointed," Emissary Kim said. "I have so looked forward to seeing Potter Min's work again."
Tre'ir hung his head.
"Humblest apologies to the honourable emissary," he mumbled.
Slowly, he took the shard from his waist pouch. He drew in a deep breath and looked down at the shard before he spoke. How odd it looked, with its rough frame of clay. But the inlay work was still delicate and clear, the glaze still fine and pure. Seeing it gave Tre'ir a last pulse of courage.
"It is but a fragment, honourable emissary, and yet I believe that it shows all of my master's skill."
And he held it out before him in cupped hands. The emissary looked surprised, but accepted the offering. He inspected it carefully, he even took off the crude wrapping of clay and peered at the edges of the shard. Then Emissary Kim sat down at his table again. He chose one of the scrolls before him, took up his brush, and began writing. Tre'ir stood with his head bowed to hide tears of shame. Obviously the emissary had already moved on to other business, but it would be rude for Tre'ir to leave before he had been dismissed. He wondered if he should take back the shard which the emissary had placed carefully on the table. Amid his despair, Tre'ir still felt grateful that the emissary had not laughed in his face for the stupidity of travelling all that way with only a single shard to show. At his side, he heard the assistant gasp in surprise. The emissary had beckoned the man and was showing him the scroll.
"Go, see that it is done," said the emissary.
"Master," the assistant hesitated, "how is it that a commission can be awarded without seeing the work?"
The man's courteous words could not mask the disapproval in his voice.
"I understand your scepticism," the emissary answered patiently, "but I have seen this man's work in Chulpo and again here."
He bent and picked up the shard from the table.
"Do you see this? Radiance of jade and clarity of water. That is what is said about the finest Celadon glaze. It is said of very few pieces."
He paused for a moment and held the shard up before him.
"I say it of this one, and the inlay work, remarkable."
His voice faded for a moment as he gazed in obvious admiration at the shard. Then he handed the scroll to the assistant.
"Now, go, and do as I bid you."
The assistant bowed abruptly and left. Emissary Kim looked at Tre'ir. There was kindness in his eyes, like Crane Man's, like Ajima's.
"I have written orders for him to secure your passage back to Chulpo by sea," he said. "You will go and deliver a message to your master for me. I am assigning him a commission. Tell me, have you worked for Potter Min long?"
Tre'ir was reeling from the man's words, spoken in such a calm, ordinary voice. Through a haze of disbelief and confusion, he heard himself answer,
"A year and a half, honourable sir."
"Good. Then perhaps you can tell me, for your master to do his best work, how many pieces per year might I expect from him?" Concentrating on the answer to the emissary's question helped steady Tre'ir.
"I think 10. Not fewer, but not many more."
He looked up and spoke with quiet pride.
"My master works slowly."
The emissary nodded solemnly.
"As well he should."
He bowed his head to Tre'ir. "If you have need of shelter here in Songdo, my assistant will see to it that you are housed and fed until the boat sails. Your coming is greatly appreciated."
Tre'ir wanted to laugh, to cry, to fling his arms around the emissary and dance wildly around the room. Instead, he bowed all the way to the ground. He could not speak, but prayed that the emissary understood his silent thanks. There were some things
that could not be moulded into words.
Chapter 13. The journey by sea was much faster than the journey across land. After the first day, when he had been sick both from excitement and from the rolling of the deck, Tryer enjoyed watching the sea in all its changes, and the sky looked different, much larger than it looked over land. Still, his main feeling during the journey was one of tingling impatience. At last, the boat drew near Chulpo, and Tryer leaned eagerly over the side. How familiar the village looked, even from this strange new angle! In his eagerness, Tryer had to stop himself from leaping into the sea when the boat was still far from shore. The final stretch of the trip, from deep water to the beach in a small rowboat, seemed to take the longest of all. From the landing beach, Tryer hurried toward the village. He had decided to go to Min first, to deliver the message about the commission, and then return to the bridge to tell Craneman the news. No one answered his call at the front of the house, so Tryer walked around to the back. Ajima was in the vegetable patch, crouched over with her back to him. He cleared his throat. "Ajima?" She whirled around so quickly that for a moment he feared she would fall over. "Tryer!" she exclaimed, her face breaking into the thousand wrinkles of her smile. "You are safely returned." "Yes, Ajima." The day was chilly. Autumn fully arrived, but her welcome swept over Tryer like a warm breeze. He bowed and could not keep himself from smiling in return. "Is the master home?" "He is at the draining site." She hesitated, as if making a decision, then spoke again. "You have news for him?" Tryer felt his smile grow broader. "Yes, Ajima." He bowed again to her and scampered through the yard toward the stream. Tryer slowed to a walk as he neared the clearing. He balled his fists tightly to contain his excitement. "Master Potter!" he called. Min was stirring the clay in the drainage bed. He put the paddle down and wiped his hands on a rag.
"You are back," he said simply.
Tryer bowed.
"I saw the royal emissary," he said, trying to keep his voice from sounding too important. "He has assigned you a commission."
Min closed his eyes and drew in a long, long breath. He let out the air in a sigh that was almost a whistle and opened his eyes. For a moment he stared off into the distance over Tryer's shoulder, then walked over to a boulder by the stream and sat down. He indicated another boulder at his side. Tryer sat down, disappointed that Min was so subdued. Tryer's own heart was still pounding so hard that he could feel his pulse in his throat. He glanced surreptitiously at the potter's face. Why did Min look so solemn? Was this not the news he had awaited nearly all his life? Tryer shrugged in his mind. It was what he should have expected from the potter. Min leaned forward, started to speak, then stopped and shook his head.
"I am sorry, Tryer," he said at last. "Your friend, from under the bridge..."
Tryer froze. "Craneman.
He was up on the bridge a few days ago. A farmer tried to cross with too great a load on his cart. The wood of the bridge railing was rotten. Your friend was bumped and jostled and the railing broke."
Tryer closed his eyes. He wanted Min to stop talking. Min leaned forward and put his hand on Tryer's shoulder.
"The water was so cold. Your friend was old. The shock was too great for his heart."
Tryer felt very strange. It was as if he had stepped out of his body and was watching himself listen to Min. This other, detached Tryer noticed that Min's eyes were soft, his face gentle. It was the first time Tryer had ever seen him so. Min was still speaking.
"I am told that it was very sudden, Tryer. Your friend did not suffer."
He reached into his waist pouch and drew forth a small object.
"When they pulled him from the river, he was clutching this in his hand." It was the little ceramic monkey, still on its crude string.
Min held it forth, but Tryer could not move to take it. Tryer heard Ajima's voice then. She seemed to appear out of thin air at his side, or had she been there the whole time? The sounds and sights around him were wavering as if seen and heard through water.
"Tryer, you will stay with us tonight," she said.
With his thoughts still outside his body, Tryer watched himself stand and allow Ajima to lead him back to the house. Min called after them.
"It is fine work, Tryer," he said.
The words came to Tryer as if from a great distance. His ears could not be trusted. Perhaps he had only imagined them. He and Ajima stepped over the threshold. The part of Tryer's mind that was still working marveled at this. He He had never been inside the house before. He caught glimpses of Min's work, a fine teapot on a shelf, an inscribed jar that held cooking tools. The rooms seemed neat and spare, but not cold with tidiness. Ajumma showed him to a small narrow room with a sleeping mat already unrolled, then left him alone. Tri'ir lay down on the mat. He closed his eyes to the light and his mind to what he had just heard and fell into a deep, dark hole of sleep. The next morning, Tri'ir rose long before the temple bell. He left the silent house and walked to the stream where he stood staring at the motion of the current. Then he bent and picked up a flat stone, but threw it so carelessly that it did not skip at all. It dropped into the water with a loud plunk. Tri'ir threw a second rock, then a third. Suddenly he was hurling a barrage of rocks into the water one after the other, harder and harder until the water roiled and foamed beneath the rain of rocks. In a senseless frenzy, Tri'ir threw leaves and sticks and clods of dirt, whatever he could get his hands on. Finally he had no breath left. He bent over, clutching his stomach and panting, then knelt in the mud of the stream bank and watched the troubled water subside. If he hadn't volunteered to take Min's work to Songdo, what then? He might have been there. He could have helped. The current carried a drifting leaf into a little eddy. Tri'ir's thoughts swirled back to the day that he had given his friend the gift. He recalled Crane Man's solemn pleasure and how he had immediately sought a piece of twine to keep the monkey near him always. Crane Man had never even hinted that Tri'ir should not make the journey. He had been proud of Tri'ir's courage. Memories layered themselves in Tri'ir's mind. Crane Man's willingness to discuss things with him, the stories he told, the mountain secrets he shared, his reading of the world around them, the way he loved a joke even at the expense of himself or his bad leg. Another recollection broke through his thoughts like a fish breaking the surface of water. "Wherever you are on your journey, Crane Man," Tri'ir whispered, "I hope you are travelling on two good legs." The tears came then. The sound of the temple bell cut through Tri'ir's muffled sobs. He rose shakily, washed his face in the stream, and walked slowly back to the house. Min was waiting for him in the yard with the cart and the axe. "Would today," Tri'ir sighed to himself. Nothing had changed. Everything was as it had been before his journey. No, not the same, at all. Crane Man was gone. Tri'ir shivered. How would he endure the coming winter, alone in the dank vegetable pit? Min handed him the axe. "Large logs," he barked. "At minimum, the girth of a man's body." Tri'ir frowned. "Why so large?" True, such logs could be split to fit through the kiln openings, but this required extra work. "What's the matter with you, boy? Do you not understand that I have been assigned a royal commission? Do you not realize how much work it will be?" Tri'ir hung his head as Min's scolding continued. "How am I to do it all myself? How are you to help me if you do not have a wheel of your own? And how is the wheel to be made if you do not fetch logs of considerable size? Go!" Min gestured impatiently toward the mountains. Tri'ir had already turned to leave when the full import of Min's words reached his understanding. "A wheel of your own?" Min was going to teach him to throw pots. Tri'ir glanced back over his shoulder, a foolishly wide grin on his face. But Min had already gone back inside, and it was Ajumma who waved to him from the yard, beckoning him to return for a lunch bowl. "Be home in time for supper," she said as she handed it to him. It was his second great surprise in as many moments. "Home," Ajumma had said. Tri'ir looked at her, puzzled. Ajumma nodded solemnly. "Tri'ir, if you would live with us from now on, I would ask a favor of you." "Anything, Ajumma," Tri'ir bowed, feeling a little dizzy. "We would like to give you a new name. Would it be agreeable to you if we were to call you Hyung Pil from now on?" Tri'ir ducked his head quickly, recalling that the son of Min had been called Hyung Gu, a name that shared a syllable. It was an honor bestowed on siblings. No longer would Tri'ir go by the name of an orphan. He could only nod wordlessly, but he felt Ajumma's smile at his back as he turned away. "Then we will see you at supper time, Hyung Pil," she called softly. Tri'ir began to jog down the path, the cart bumping before him. He had too much to think about and felt lost in the bewildering welter of his thoughts. "Crane Man, a wheel of my own, a home with Ajumma,
and a new name. Min will teach me to throw pots. Crane Man. Trier shook his head hard like a dog shaking off water. He groped about in his mind for an image that would calm him. A prunus vase, with a plum branch to complete its beauty. His dream of making one returned, stronger than ever now, for it would be more than a dream. He could almost feel the clay under his hands rising on the wheel, his own wheel, into a shape that was grace itself. He would make replicas, dozens if need be, until the glaze was like jade and water, and the vase would be carefully, delicately inlaid with the design of... Trier frowned a little and looked up at the mountain. The trees that were shedding the last of their leaves stood bare but dignified among the loyal green of the pines. Trier's gaze followed the sweep of the trunks and branches until he saw their outlines clean and pure against the sky. How long would it be before he had skill enough to create a design worthy of such a vase? One hill, one valley. One day at a time he would journey through the years until he came upon the perfect design. Trier leaned forward and pushed the cart up the mountain path. A certain prunus vase is among the most prized of Korea's many cultural treasures. It is the finest example of inlaid Celadon pottery ever discovered and has been dated to the 12th century. The vase's most remarkable feature is its intricate inlay work. Each of the 46 round medallions is formed by a white outer ring and a black inner ring. Within every circle, carved and then inlaid with great skill, there is a crane in graceful flight. Clouds drift between the medallions, with more cranes soaring among the clouds, and the glaze is a delicate shade of greyish-green. It is called the Thousand Cranes Vase. Its maker is unknown. This is Graham Malcolm. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Single Shard by Linda Sue Park. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Karen DeMattia. Text copyright 2001 by Linda Sue Park. Production copyright 2002, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.